Over 15.
Yeah, maybe.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the January, what's the date today? 17th meeting of the Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee. We do have a quorum, and so Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have. I move, Madam Chair, I have a move approval.
Let's see. We have a motion to approve the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the January 11th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. And so today is a great day. We are hearing our first bill today, House File 49, Representative Ruth Richardson. Come and join us. Yeah.
That's we don't good. Fight.
No,
okay.
That's awesome. Have a seat. Yeah. Thank you for being here, Representative Richardson. Welcome to committee. Let's see. I will move House File be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And I think there is an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. So I will also move the A1 to get the bill in the shape. All those in favor? I'm sorry? Okay, thank you. All those in favor of adopting the A1, say aye.
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 All those opposed,
no.
Say nay. The amendment is adopted. And with that, Representative Richardson, please tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And to clarify, the A1 amendment clarifies the scope of the bill and the public and the utilities that it would apply to: public utilities, generation and transmission, electric co-op associations, municipal power agencies, and municipal utilities that provide service to 10,000 customers or more. And it also defines some of the supplier diversity terminology that is traditionally used related to small minority women and veteran-owned businesses, and also establishes a commission that would organize and host an annual workshop for utilities that's open to members of the public. So House File 49, as amended, builds upon work that the legislature passed in 2019 that resulted in the establishment of the Energy Utility Diversity Stakeholder Group. The final report was prepared and submitted, examining the challenges and opportunities for Minnesota utilities to attract a diverse workforce with the skills to advance the industry and also increase supplier diversity of energy utilities. As the report highlights, Minnesota's utilities do more than deliver affordable, reliable electric and natural gas service to homes, businesses, and public institutions across the state. Investor-owned cooperative and municipal energy utilities also provide economic opportunity to hundreds of Minnesota firms and communities and tens of thousands of workers. The economic development opportunities created by the utility sector are a public benefit that should be made available on an equitable and fair basis to Minnesotans of diverse backgrounds. The report also highlighted the industry's acknowledgement that there is opportunity for diversification of workforce and supplier diversity. This bill is about access and opportunity. It brings value to the utilities and the community served, and it's also acknowledgement that this work is everyone's job. The research tells us that supplier diversity promotes economic development in diverse communities, and by increasing competition and diversity in the supply chain, generates better return on investment for companies that meaningfully engage in it. It's also about addressing inequities and injustices in the industry. And the bill would require that utilities submit annual utility diversity reports in order to monitor their spend with diverse entities. And with that, Madam Chair, I have a couple of testifiers who are here to testify in support of the bill.
Great. And before we go to testifiers, do members have any questions as we're looking at the bill? Or should we go ahead with the testimony? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, thank you for bringing this bill. In the amendment that you adopted, the author's amendment, you excluded the community solar gardens. What was the reason for that?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo, for the question. With this bill, we're focusing mainly on the utilities. The plan is to hold this bill over, and so happy to discuss if there's additional entities that we would want to include as well. Thank you for the question.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Maybe we'll go ahead to your presenters. It looks like first you have up Mari Ojeda with Fresh Energy. Please come on up to the table, and if you'll enter your name for the record, please.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, Chair ACOM and committee members. My name is Mari Ojeda. I am a senior policy associate on the Energy Access and Equity team at Fresh Energy. As an independent energy policy nonprofit that is working to advance equitable outcomes across Minnesota's energy sector, Fresh Energy appreciates the concepts that are included in this bill. In times of dramatic and transformational change in the energy sector, access to good-paying local jobs is especially important from an equity perspective. According to a recent report from Clean Energy Economy Minnesota, our state currently has almost 58,000 clean energy jobs, with thousands more in the broader utility industry across the state. That number is significant, but it's important to ensure that number also includes an equitable and a diverse representation of Minnesotans, including women, people of color, and veterans. We know that there are many barriers to entry to clean energy opportunities that are especially high for diverse populations. Given the opportunity presented by this growing and ever-changing workforce, the ideas in House File 49 are important components in considering how we can align economic equity with energy decision-making. Fresh Energy believes that all Minnesotans should have access to family-sustaining jobs, including those in the energy sector. Fresh Energy supports House File 49 as amended, which will help Minnesota track our progress towards the goal of an equitable and accessible energy transition for all. We are happy to provide support in future conversations about this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Ojeda. And next we have Jamez Staples from Renewable Energy Partners. Welcome to committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair ACOM, members of the committee. My name is Jamez Staples. I'm the CEO of Renewable Energy Partners. We're a private sector development firm based out of North Minneapolis. I'm an original member of the Energy Utility Diversity Group. I was one of a handful of non-utility and non-governmental entities that actively participated in this study that came out, and a lot of information came as a result of it. I was reminded by Representative Richardson here that this is our third go at this, so hopefully we'll get something done. As a social entrepreneur, I started Renewable Energy Partners specifically with the focus in mind of addressing climate change and poverty and helping to address Minnesota's wicked disparity around racial employment. And so the objective has been to make sure that this bill passes, because if we don't start to make sure that we have a workforce of the future that's a little bit more diverse than what it has been in the past, we won't have energy workforce in the future because of the browning of Minnesota. The report that came out in 2020 identified the findings and the recommendations and the findings. And the findings specifically called out the fact that we need to make sure that there's access to skills and training for young people focused on STEM careers, because if we don't do that, we won't have people that have the understanding and the basic knowledge to move to the next level. So if you think about your K-12 educational system, if you don't get the STEM educational components early on, every year you continue to move, you don't have that foundational skill that you need to make sure that you can build to the next block. So I ask that you all consider this bill beyond just this bill here around the idea that we need to diversify the workforce and have this mandatory requirement, but we also need to do something better around our educational system for our youth. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Staples. And before you leave, just maybe I should have done this with the previous presenter as well. Any questions from committee members for either of our presenters? Seeing none, thank you so much for your testimony. And we Any questions to Ruth at this point? To Representative Richardson?
Are we done with the presenters?
We have some public testimony, but we're done with presentations, yes.
Okay. Take them and then we can ask.
Okay. Then I think we'll go ahead to public comments and would ask if you could just keep it to a couple minutes, please. First, we have Shuba Harris, principal attorney with Xcel Energy. Welcome to the committee. Join us at the table and please enter your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Acom and members of the Energy and Climate Committee. My name is Shuba Harris and I'm an attorney at Xcel Energy. I'm pleased to be here today and to share with this committee the company's support of House File 49, the Utility Diversity Reporting Bill. I'd like to thank Representative Richardson for introducing this bill and also thank the Minnesota Public Utilities Commissioners for their efforts to prioritize diversity and equity in commission proceedings. We share these goals, which is why we support this bill. At Xcel Energy, we are aiming to create an inclusive work culture where employees are treated equitably and diversity is not only accepted but celebrated. We strongly believe in the value that a diverse workforce brings and the importance of having employees who reflect the communities we serve. By viewing opportunities and challenges through multiple lenses, we know that we are better able to leverage our strengths and achieve our strategic priorities to deliver clean, reliable, and affordable service. Our CEO and senior leadership team are striving for diversity and equity to be an integral part of our organization, how we operate, and how we create a sustainable future. We've taken a variety of steps to promote diversity in our organization. A few highlights include adding an incentive-based metric to the corporate scorecard in 2021, tying a portion of our executive pay to diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've implemented an executive sponsorship program where top leaders are personally communicating and sponsoring diverse top talent throughout the organization. In 2022, after the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission order in our resource plan, we established an equity stakeholder advisory group to deepen our relationships with communities of color and elevate the voices of our BIPOC communities in utility decision making. Last year, we also sought and received approval of a workforce training program to create a diverse pipeline for energy-related construction jobs. These and other efforts are resulting in progress. Our current senior executive team is comprised of 33% women and 22% ethnically or racially diverse leaders that set a strong example of fostering an open and inclusive environment. The senior leadership team, comprised of vice presidents and above, has increased its female representation by 6% and diverse representation by 5% over the past 3 years. Every year we set targets to further broaden our supplier base, encouraging businesses owned by women or veterans or whose owners are ethnically or racially diverse to participate in our procurement process. Through our engagement with small and diverse suppliers, we estimate that we have contributed approximately $2.9 billion to the U.S. economy and supported nearly 20,000 jobs in 2021. We have been nationally recognized for our efforts. In 2022, Xcel Energy was recognized by Ethisphere as one of the world's most ethical companies, by Fortune as one of the world's most admired companies, by Human Rights as one of the best places to work for LGBTQ equality, and by Military Times as one of the best places for veterans. We are proud of the steps we've taken and the direction we are headed. We are committed to continuing to take steps to lead our industry in achieving diversity and inclusion goals. We appreciate the transparency this bill will provide to ensuring our workforce representation demographics and goals are accessible to the public, including our Minnesota customers. Recognizing and celebrating our differences and championing an inclusive culture strengthens our organization and the world in which we live. I thank you for the opportunity to address this committee today and share some of the company's exciting efforts to advance our diversity and inclusion goals.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. I think we're going to hold questions to presenters or to people who are public testimony. And we
towards the end?
Of presenters, but not typically people who are here to Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Harris. Next, we'll have Mr. Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Yeah. Welcome to committee, and please enter your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I don't need to second everything that Shuba just said. I do want to add I just want to say we were a little disappointed at the removal of the community solar gardens developer, owners, I should say, from this. I think it's appropriate to limit the application of this bill to the size of the organization because that does matter. But many people don't know, we have owners of community solar gardens that are larger companies than Xcel Energy. Some of them are utilities from across the country. Some of them are investment firms from across the country. And we think it's appropriate that they participate as well. Community solar gardens now make up 850 megawatts of our energy supply. That is significant. And we think the owners of those gardens should participate as well. Look forward to working with the author to see if we can make some further changes to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Next, we have Jennifer Cady with Minnesota Power. Please welcome to the committee. Enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jennifer Cady. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Minnesota Power. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 49 this afternoon. Like Ms. Harris, I will share some of what we're doing to promote diversity and inclusion at our company. Minnesota Power serves 145,000 customers in northern Minnesota, and ALLETE is our corporate entity headquartered in Duluth. ALLETE is a longtime champion of women in leadership and diversity in all of its forms. Our view of sustainability in action includes nurturing a more diverse workplace and supply chain that helps develop stronger and more equitable communities and ultimately contributes to our collective success. As evidence of this commitment, last year ALLETE was recognized for the third year in a row as a company of special distinction in a women's corporate leadership census of Minnesota's largest public companies. ALLETE is governed by a corporate board that is 50% female, with women as both our president, CEO, and chair of the board, and lead external director. Additionally, 50% of ALLETE's executive officers are women, and ALLETE has been recognized by Moody's as the most diverse board in the electric utility sector. In 2019, when the legislature directed the Public Utilities Commission to convene a stakeholder group to examine the challenges and opportunities for utilities to attract a diverse workforce and increase diversity in their supply chain, Minnesota Power was all in. I was proud to serve alongside Anita Grace and Jose Perez as the co-vice chair of the Energy Utility Diversity Stakeholder Group, or EUDG, and we reported our work back to the legislature in 2020. This important body of work captured consensus recommendations from over 70 stakeholders representing utilities, organized labor, community groups, advocates, and state government representatives. I'm proud to say that the EUDG's 2020 report did not just sit on a shelf somewhere, but in fact, we took the recommendations and implemented them immediately. With commission approval, Minnesota Power built three new solar projects during the COVID-19 pandemic and did so by implementing every single one of the EUDG's recommendations on supplier diversity, going so far as hiring a dedicated professional to work in this area specifically. I'm happy to be here today and share our work and our support of House File 49. However, I would encourage the committee to leverage the thoughtful work of the EUDG in this legislation. For example, the EUDG identified 7 categories of diverse suppliers, several more than are currently reflected in the bill, including LGBTQ-owned businesses, small economically disadvantaged businesses, disability-owned businesses, and hub-zone businesses. Ensuring we capture all categories of diverse suppliers in our reporting and ensuring our diversity efforts are reflective of the communities we serve is critical. We appreciate the good work Representative Richardson and others have done on this legislation, and we're happy to collaborate as the bill moves forward. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have John Pacheco, Chair of the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Welcome to committee. Please have a seat and enter your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear today. Again, my name is John Pacheco, and I'm president of the Latino Chamber of Commerce of Minnesota. I'm also a Met Council member representing District 6. But I'm here today to support House File 49 because we think this is very important for our constituency and our communities. I also sat on the EUG committee. Actually, I chaired the Supplier Diversity Committee of that body. And I thought that it was a great group of people to sit down and really look at things and have the ability to debate what your size you are, what you're gaining, and all of that. But it was, overall, it was our goal to facilitate, was to examine the challenges and opportunities of Minnesota energy utilities and attract a diverse workforce and to increase supplier diversity. I can tell you that was 2 years ago, but I don't think a lot has changed. If anything, they haven't gotten better as far as workforce. It's a very challenging time for everybody, so our communities and the state as a whole. And so we really think this here is an opportunity for us, based on the numbers that will be provided once this bill passes, to really dig deep on how we're going to provide the workforce of the future. Latino population is one of the youngest, if not the youngest population in the state. And so we're looking at where's the jobs for our kids in the future. And so we're looking at being able to gather the data, looking at the challenges that people have, looking at the barriers, what can we do to facilitate that growth. And we don't see the workforce, for example, as another affirmative action effort. This is beyond affirmative action. Affirmative action is a model where you put a quota up there and say our goal is 10% and you work that and then you go home. And sometimes it's not achieved, but no one does anything until the next year reporting. That's the affirmative action model. We're looking at a workforce model that engages the community, that prepares them for the work going forward, that looks at the challenges, that comes back the next year and says, what did we do right? What did we do? How can we grow what we're doing today? So I always refer to it's not your dad's affirmative action model that we're trying to establish here. What we are doing is trying to build for the future. And I think if anyone, your group here as far as the utilities go, you know this is the long haul. Everything is 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, and alike going forward. And so building for the future is something that you all have before you often here. In regards to supplier diversity, it's very similar. We have a number of small entrepreneurs and a number of large businesses. And looking for the opportunity to do business across the state, looking for mentors to help their business grow, looking for the next contract that one of the Department of Transportation or even the Metropolitan Council would look at. And so we have the ability there. We have some talent out there. It's how do we go forward with it? We see that House 549, it takes us to that next step. If this legislation is adopted, we'll have information about the challenges faced by companies to increase workforce and supplier diversity, including actions they could take to help identify potential employers and vendors. Provide a list of successful actions taken to increase workforce and supplier diversity, and produce best practices. We ask that you support House 549. For our community and for the state, I think it does us all a great service. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And finally, we have Mr. Lewis with Interfaith Power and Light. Welcome to committee. If you could please enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair Acom and members of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Joshua Lewis, and I'm a climate justice organizer for Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. I'm going to ask for your excuse if I read a little slowly. I'm recovering from a concussion, and it's the symptoms are kind of rearing their head right now. But this is important. I want to make sure we get our statement out from our community. I'm here representing MNIPL to testify on their behalf and also on behalf of Honor the Earth. Both IPL and Honor the Earth strongly support the passage of House File 49, authored by Representative Richardson, and we thank her for her ongoing efforts to increase the participation of people of color and indigenous people in the energy sector. House File 49 will ensure that utility companies that serve Minnesota residents will collect and report demographic information to improve the diversity of the utility's workforce and suppliers. Addressing diversity and inclusion is vital as companies, policymakers, and communities take steps to meet the challenge of climate change, which has been shown to impact marginalized populations disproportionately. These reports will help the state support the utility's goals and efforts to increase diversity in the workplace, including current workforce representation and percentages, and all procurement goals and actual spending for female-owned, minority-owned, veteran-owned, and small business enterprises each year. If this legislation is adopted, we'll have information about the challenges faced by the companies to increase workforce and supplier diversity, including suggestions regarding actions they could take to help identify potential employees and vendors, which would provide a list of successful actions taken to increase workforce and supplier diversity and general best practices. Many new good-paying jobs are being created in the energy industry every day, and indigenous people and black and Hispanic and immigrant populations need to have access to these jobs. And we need your support to ensure we have the proper public infrastructure to train and open the door to our communities in this industry. We are ready to partner with Representative Richardson, Hispanics in Energy, the utility companies in Minnesota, the Public Utilities Commission, and all the people who have worked since 2019 to increase the participation of people of color and indigenous in the energy sector. We must examine the challenges and opportunities Minnesota's energy utilities face to attract a diverse workforce with the skills needed to advance a 21st century industry and to increase supplier diversity of energy utilities. We encourage members to review the findings of the Energy Utility Diversity Stakeholder Group Report, submitted on January 15, 2020, which this legislation aims to address. Also want to say happy belated Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And I feel like this bill, when it comes to addressing wealth equity, in particular the wealth building opportunities that lie in the energy sector in both ownership of the production of and also participation in the workforce of, represents a sort of a mountaintop moment. Right, it's not the promised land. It's not delivering complete economic justice to our communities that have faced discrimination in housing and in training and in the ability to have access to quality education and really even knowledge about some of these sectors of work and the jobs that lie therein that could provide for a working class, middle class families, including more specifically to the state of Minnesota, issues such as the destruction of the historic Rondo neighborhood for public investment, and understanding that being able to analyze the landscape economically when it comes to the jobs being provided and the wealth being built off of the public investment in energy is going to give us the tools and the keys needed to address inequity in that space and ensure that we are moving in the right direction when it comes to building up the pipelines so that we do have more minority, black, and indigenous people of color involved in this sector. This report would examine current and projected employment in the energy utility sector, will provide information on possible approaches to assist workers in energy utilities to develop a diverse workforce that has the skills to build, maintain, and operate the electricity system of the future, reviews key trends that have shaped employment in this sector and the demographics of the sector, including the underrepresentation of women, veterans, and minorities in employment and leadership. This bill also identifies the challenges to replacing retiring workers, examines the imbalance of available worker skills to utility workforce needs, identifies the challenges and possible approaches to increasing supplier diversity, and considers whether information regarding workforce and supplier diversity should be included and considered as a part of any resource plan filed by a utility with the commission. We urge you to vote for and pass HF 49. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis, for your testimony. Looks like we've got a couple of questions before we go on to amendments. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking through the bill, appreciate your time, Representative Richardson. Kind of looking at, you know, with your amendment here, it talked a lot about the owners of the business and, you know, and kind of the tracking of the ownership. But, you know, what if I were to propose a situation, well, let's say you had a minority-owned business whose all their employees were white, that wouldn't be considered in the grouping here. How would that translate into this report, and how would that be viewed within the subject matter that we're trying to cover here?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski, for the question. You know, in terms of the way that these certification programs have worked in the past, either on the state, city, county, and the federal level, it has been based upon ownership in terms of really ensuring that as you are setting up these programs, that they are meeting the goals of really diversifying sort of the supplier, the ownership of that supplier piece. And on a workforce perspective, this is also about tracking on a workforce side as well. So both are critical and both are important. But in terms of the way that the certification programs have been set up and designed, they are tied to ownership.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a follow up too. You know, I just from a perspective of looking at kind of from that supply chain resolution and looking kind of where things come at. You know. Let's say, you know, 95% of the solar panels come from China that are being installed in the United States. How does that count towards these reports as far as, you know, from a minority perspective and the rest? Does that get included in that or you know, how does that work?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. So in terms of looking at the way that these programs have worked within the past and what is being proposed within this bill, it's about reporting on the workforce numbers that are currently in play, and it gives you the opportunity to sort of see year over year because you get a baseline in terms of what a workforce looks like, and then you're able to track over time whether there are improvements that are being made, if things are getting worse. And it's also, I think, an important opportunity from a workforce perspective to be able to work in community because there's a lot of technical assistance that is available out there to ensure that if organizations are setting internal goals around what they want to see from a workforce perspective and what they want to see from a supplier diversity perspective, that there's transparency in terms of what the spend is looking like on the supplier diversity side and being able to track over time what that looks like. In terms of thinking about where items are being purchased from, you have the ability to sort of, you know, to also think about whether it might make sense to talk about tracking where purchases are being made from as part of something that could be collected. And you can also think about it, I think, in terms of thinking about if you are living in a certain area, how many employees from within that area are being benefited as well. Because part of this is ensuring that the workforce is reflective of what's seen within the community and that the supplier spend is also represented as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems interesting, you know, this is very, you know, it's a unique conversation we're having kind of about race and you know, how it affects the production of electricity in the United States. And from an industry standpoint, it seemed like when the Biden administration came on into office, there was a tariff put up, and it seemed like there was a lot of fear that the Chinese slave labor was dumping products onto onto our U.S. markets, and there was a tariff put up. And then we saw through the industry, whether it be minority-owned companies, all across the board, we saw a pushback to say, hey, we want to get rid of that tariff. We need to lift it so that we can continue to build these projects. Like, do you feel that that's, you know, by pushing back against that, do you feel like that's a going backwards as far as, you know, promoting, you know, U.S. produced things, or, you know, from a, I mean, folks are enslaved in China over these projects, and it sounds really good here in the United States, but, you know, it's a living hell for people in other parts of the world. And, you know, do you think there should be anything kind of tied in with this to say, you know, hey, if you want to qualify for these contracts, we want you to be a minority-owned business owner, but we also don't want you to support, you know, slavery in other parts of the world. Now, do you think that would be, would you think you'd consider that as this bill moves forward? You know, we don't have an amendment prepared for that, but do you think you could, you know, maybe support something like that that would kind of help move people past the injustices of the past, but also the ones that are going on currently?
Representative Richards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski, for the question as well. I'm excited to continue to work on this bill in a number of ways. It is great to be able to come to committee and see people wanting more conversation around equity, so I always welcome that. And am open to having conversations. The one thing that I would also say as well is this is not a new conversation that's going on. This is a conversation that's been going on in our country since 1968, and it hasn't gotten the attention that it should always have received. But in terms of thinking about supplier diversity and workforce diversity, these are long-term conversations that have not really gotten the attention that they deserve.
And next question, we have Representative Holland.
Thank you, Chair Akam. So first of all, I would just like to thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this to our committee. I think we spend a lot of time talking about climate justice and environmental justice and thinking about how climate change does disproportionately impact communities of color and low-income communities. But I think it's important that we also acknowledge that this is a tremendous opportunity for communities of color, and that we think about climate change in general as an opportunity, both for us to make improvements in our communities and to combat and mitigate what we know is happening, but also for businesses to take off and to be able to be really successful. So I love that you are thinking about this from both sides of that perspective. My question is really around, I see this as a bit of a carrot, like in a carrot and stick sort of situation, right? As we do reporting, hopefully this is, you know, it's required that it be taken into consideration, the year-over-year reporting that is done by these entities. My question is there any stick in this situation? Because I think, maybe I'm just cynical, but I think even with the best of intentions, when we are not forced to make changes, we tend to stagnate. And I would not like to see that happen in this situation.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for the question. I think the important step that this bill takes is about getting to transparency, because right now, unless an organization is willingly collecting this information, we don't even have an idea of what the baseline is. And so I think as an important first step, it's really being able to get to sort of what that baseline data looks like. And I also just want to lift up what some of the other testifiers talked about as well. This is just one step in the process. There's definitely additional work that needs to be done around thinking about our education system and thinking also about what other sort of motivators could be out there to ensure that we're actually seeing year-over-year growth. You know, when we talk about diversity and we talk about inclusion, it's not just about diversity for diversity's sake. There's a business case for this as well, and the research is also very clear about how having access to a diverse workforce and to diverse suppliers makes good business sense.
Any follow-up, Representative Hall?
No, thank you. I agree. This is a really important first step. Thank you.
Seeing no more questions at this time, we can move to amendments. There's an A3. Is anyone offering the A3? Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I would offer the A3 amendment, and this just is it kind of goes, we really appreciate your author's amendment, Representative Richardson, in kind of limiting the scope of kind of the impact on this, especially with, you know, the smaller utilities that may not have just extra staff people around with their efficiencies and that. And this just really clarifies it. You know, we've come at the legislature really appreciating locally elected officials and kind of their dynamic vision for what's best for the people that they represent. And particularly this amendment speaks to the cooperative program. You know, we've got a very celebrated electrical cooperative program here in the state of Minnesota. We have co-ops around the state that are member-owned, so folks that are actually using electricity own and elect their directors. And this would allow those folks to really encapsulate this vision, whether it's more to do more than what you maybe have encapsulated in this bill or to do less, to best fit their organization because they are locally elected, but also the municipalities because they have city council people, they have small cities and towns around the state. This obviously with your 10,000 constituent or customer or whatever that your amendment led to, this just defines that there is a difference between investor-owned utilities and municipalities and cooperatives. And you know, I would hope you view this as a friendly amendment and accept it.
Representative Richardson, do you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski, for bringing this amendment. At this time, I'm going to ask for a no vote, but I'm open to starting the conversation around this. It sounds like there are some amendments to be made. Definitely hearing from the committee around the solar garden and also talking about the expansions of categories. And I'm happy to keep conversations open as the bill is going to be laid over to talk with you a little bit more.
Any other discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say nay.
Nay.
No.
The amendment is not adopted. And any final discussion to the bill? Representative Richardson, anything to close?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this bill forward. And I also would just like to thank all of the testifiers and the members of the utility work group as well. There was a lot of time, effort, and energy that went into that report, and proud to say that it's not collecting dust on a shelf. So thank you for the opportunity.
Great. House File 49 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Richardson. And we're going to transition to some presentations this afternoon. And first up, we have Kathleen Schuler, Policy Director for Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate. Welcome to committee. Please enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to bring up my presentation.
Great. And there should be handouts.
As Representative Aikman mentioned, I am Kathleen Schuler. I am Policy Director with Health Professionals for Healthy Climate. And we are a network of doctors, nurses, and other health professionals across the state of Minnesota. And we're working for a healthy climate to protect public health. We believe that we know that climate change is a health emergency, and many health professional organizations have joined us in signing a declaration on climate change and health. These include various physician organizations, nursing organization, mental health, and public health. Just to review the health impacts of climate change, fossil fuel pollution is responsible globally for almost 9 million premature deaths per year. We're seeing extreme heat, severe storms and flooding, wildfires, drought, vector-borne diseases like Lyme disease, and air pollution that are increasingly impacting the physical and mental health of Minnesotans. We know that underlying socioeconomic conditions, health disparities, and disproportionate exposure to pollution place communities of color and low-income communities at highest risk from climate change, and they have fewer resources to adapt to and recover from climate events. One of the effects of climate change that really impacts communities is extreme heat. We have more very hot days, higher humidity, longer and hotter heat waves, and 14.5 million Americans are exposed to heat waves annually. This causes dehydration, heat exhaustion, and risk of death from heat stroke. People in cities, low income and rural communities, older people, children, and outdoor workers are at highest risk. Pregnant women are also at high risk. Dr. Rachel Hardiman, who's a researcher here at the University of Minnesota, she studied a group of Minnesota moms who were exposed to an extended heat wave where it was high 90s for a week. And they were at risk for higher risk for preterm birth, and it was much higher for black mothers than for white mothers. Climate change is also causing more air pollution. Fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, which is the very small particles that get into the lungs, is linked to 350,000 premature deaths annually in the U.S. Air pollution increases with high heat and the wildfires that we're seeing across the country. It exacerbates asthma and allergies. Air pollution impacts every part of the human body, from the brain to the lungs to the heart to the kidneys. It increases the risk for cardiovascular diseases, for asthma and other respiratory ailments, and including stroke. And then the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health estimate that 2,000 to 4,000 deaths are caused by air pollution every year in the state of Minnesota. Communities that are BIPOC communities or communities that are low income are higher risk for air pollution exposure. And compared to the statewide average, communities of color and indigenous communities, 93% of them are exposed to air pollution, 93% above the guidelines. So one of the benefits of a clean energy transition is if we switch out gas appliances, I know this has been in the news lately, you can improve health and save energy. So gas stoves emit nitrous oxides, carbon monoxide, and particulate matter, which can increase the risk for asthma, heart attacks, COPD, stroke, and developmental delay. And BIPOC and low-income communities bear a larger burden of gas stove pollution because they're usually renters, so they don't have a choice about the type of appliances they have. They may live in a smaller home or an older home, so there's higher levels of indoor air pollution. Electric appliances are 3 to 5 times more efficient than gas. They can reduce energy costs and improve indoor air quality. In California, they estimated that replacing gas with electric appliances would prevent 350 premature deaths a year and yield $3.5 billion in health benefits from cleaner air. Another benefit of electrification for heating and cooling is that if you install a heat pump in the home, you can also heat it as well as cool it, and that's a benefit for the fact that we're seeing more heat waves. As health professionals, we're really interested in the co-benefits of greenhouse gas reductions on our health. I talked about the fact that fossil fuel pollution that causes air pollution is responsible for thousands of or millions of premature deaths, and that reducing greenhouse gas emissions prevents a lot of chronic illnesses. To illustrate this, the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed by Congress, it's estimated that the investments from this bill, which is $369 billion in climate action, is meant to reduce greenhouse gas reductions 40% by 2030. And this would prevent 3,600 premature deaths, 100,000 asthma attacks, and 400,000 less work days. It also invests $60 billion in EJ initiatives to help communities be more resilient in the face of climate change. So in summary, some of the policies that can create equity are transportation systems that create more active transit and public transit,
incentives for electric vehicle adoption and the infrastructure to support that, electric school buses and public transit buses, and then energy efficiency with pre-weatherization and weatherization, access to solar and transition from gas, and also reducing pollution burden in environmental justice communities. And I know there's going to be a cumulative impacts bill that's going to be introduced that will help that situation. We also need to invest in resilient infrastructure, tree planting, and local food systems, and also help communities to access the IRA environmental justice grant funding for community planning that's available to them. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Schuler. I appreciate the testimony, and just want to also call people's members' attention to the one-pager that refers to the report that the Health Professionals for Healthy Climate did on climate justice and public health in Minnesota. And so I will just maybe hold on 1 second, Ms. Schuler, just if we have a little bit of time, if there's any questions for the presenter, Representative Swiginski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Appreciate your time. You know, from a particular matter, you know, as far as energy production, has any studies been done whether or not the energy is produced here in the United States or, let's say, where we ship coal and other parts like to China? Like, if they're burning, you know, if we get rid of a coal plant here in the United States and they build 10 more in China, how does that affect, you know, the health?
Well, I'm sorry, Representative Wyszynski. Obviously, any coal burning is going to affect our health. I mean, we're focusing here on reducing our emissions here in the United States. We certainly hope that China will reduce those as theirs as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just from a scientific basis, though, like if you're studying health, which that's what you're talking about here today, and you study that we get rid, let's say we get rid of one coal plant in the United States, but they build 10 more in China, like how will that, from a scientific standpoint, improve health?
Well, Representative Swiginski, I don't think the two are linked. I mean, we have global climate goals that were set, and us closing down a coal plant in the United States will reduce the impacts, but we don't have control of what China does. So I guess I don't understand the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just asking, you know, because we're saying, well, hey, if we do this here in the United States, it's going to mean that we're going to have all these health benefits. But I'm just saying it's sometimes a multiple factor because they're getting built other places on the globe. Like, I don't know, I'm just asking, has that been studied?
Well, Representative Swiginski, I'll just say many of the things that Ms. Schuler talked about were also gas cooktops in your house. So there were things that were very local that have very local impacts as well as on a global basis. And I think that we've had this conversation in committee before in regards to how we may not have control over other states and countries, but we can certainly be a leader and model the behavior that we hope that others will be. Ms. Schuler, do you have any response before we move on?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo, did you have a quick question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, if the testifier could maybe bring up the slide that says health benefits of switching out gas appliances from the presentation she did. Madam Chair, to the testifier, I noticed the language is very precise here, and I'm just going to read it specifically. It says, gas stoves emit nitrogen oxide, carbon monoxide, and particulate matter, which increase risk for asthma, heart attacks, COPD, stroke, and development delay. And Madam Chair, to the testifier, is it your testimony today that gas stoves do those things, or that trace elements from gas stoves in those situations do those things? Two very distinct points.
Well, I would say it would be the emissions from the gas stoves, and it depends on the circumstances in the house, too, the type of ventilation that they have. And I have some citations for that if you'd like to see the scientific information.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the testifier, actually, I have done quite a bit of reading on this, and I am familiar with the science on it. and I'm trying to think of the scientific way of describing this, but stating that natural gas appliances cause strokes, development delay, heart attacks, or asthma. I think the scientific term is that it's a complete load of crap. It's not true. The reality is what is being cooked on a stove, what the items are in there, have a far more greater impact in terms of airborne pollution than whether it's natural gas. Now, if a stove is using, if it's not burning properly, if it's only cooking, if we're only using 50 or 70% of the natural gas, so there's not proper maintenance, then absolutely that can be dangerous. But the reality is, Madam Chair and members, that through the last couple of decades, the use of natural gas has resulted in dramatic reductions in emissions in the state of Minnesota, both on a personal and electricity generation standpoint. On top of that, as a result of that, we've been able to be more energy independent in the United States, and we've been able to save money. So by deploying natural gas, as the abundance of shale gas in North Dakota and other regions has existed, we have reduced pollution, we've saved money, and we've been able to be more energy independent. And so I did read the study that came out, I read it cover to cover, that falsely claimed that gas stoves are somehow creating higher asthma rates for kids, that homes that have gas stoves, somehow that kids are at risk from it. That is complete junk science, and it's not my job to refute every single point that's brought to this committee, but no one in this committee should be under the illusion that asthma is at a greater risk because of people who have gas appliances in their homes. That's just not true.
Well, I don't see a question there, so I think what we'll do is move on to our next presenter. Next, we have Annalee Baines with Fresh Energy. Welcome to committee. Thank you, Ms. Schuler. Welcome to committee, Ms. Baines. I'll ask you to please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Anjali Baines, and I'm here on behalf of Fresh Energy. I'm just going to get my presentation here. Perfect. Thank you all again for inviting me to speak today. My name is Anjali Baines, and I'm here on behalf of Fresh Energy, a 30-year-old policy organization based in St. Paul, Minnesota, advocating for a transition to a clean and equitable clean energy economy that benefits all Minnesotans. You've heard some wonderful presenters today and in previous committee meetings that have laid out what's at stake with our changing climate. My goal today is to solidify the connection between climate and air pollution and their disproportionate impacts on Minnesotans of color and under-resourced residents, also known as those with lower incomes. I won't spend too much time on the first two slides because it has been covered in previous sessions, but just wanted to emphasize that air pollution shares many of the same sources as climate pollution or greenhouse gases. This figure from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency showed that much of air pollution comes from on- and off-road vehicles, the blue and orange sections of the graph, with another fifth from industrial sources like power plants and manufacturing facilities. Transportation industry also contribute highly to climate change, with transportation comprising the largest set of emissions, as well as industry contributing quite a bit as well. That means addressing climate change also addresses air pollution, and that we can reduce the harmful health impacts from both by pursuing clean energy solutions. This is even more important when we see how the impacts from air pollution and climate change, while harming everyone, are disproportionately borne by under-resourced Minnesotans and those of color across the state. This figure, also from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, shows the relative risk level from poor air quality experienced across racial and home ownership demographics in the state. We can see that non-white residents, in particular Black and Indigenous folks, experience higher air quality risks above the state average, with renters experiencing the highest level of risk from poor air quality as compared to homeowners and white residents. The reason, The reason for this are many, including a higher likelihood of living near polluting facilities or highways for these particular groups. Analogous disparities exist for climate change impacts as well. For one illustrative example, let's look at extreme heat here in the Twin Cities. This first map shows surface temperatures on a particularly hot day in July in 2016. Red indicates temperatures above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, with green being in the low 80s and mid-70s. honing in on the North and South Minneapolis areas, which I've circled here on the map, we see particularly high surface temperatures, which correlate to, tend to correlate to more pavement and fewer green spaces or tree canopies that tend to mitigate hot weather. When we compare this map to one of racial demographics, so paying attention to that circle, similar area on this map, we see that the redder, hotter areas correlate with a higher proportion of non-white residents, as indicated by darker blue areas on this map. This is also true for income, which, same area circled, also tend to be correlated with the hotter areas with a higher proportion of residents at or below the federal poverty level, leaving those same areas as shown in the darker green section on this map. Now, this is just one example of how the worst impacts of climate change can burden communities of color and under-resourced households the most. Other examples also exist across the state. For instance, as we will see in my colleague's presentation, two-thirds of energy-burdened Minnesotans live outside the Twin Cities, so that means that the cost burden from needing to cool their homes during extreme heat will fall heavily on those residents, which is another example of climate change's uneven impacts, in this case, for greater Minnesotans. So we've seen how air pollution and climate pollution are linked and how both unevenly impact communities of color and under-resourced households. The good news is that we can design the clean energy transition to help reduce these current inequities. Such design solutions include investing in affordable and accessible clean transportation that makes sense for the geography, such as electric buses and electric vehicle car sharing, developing a clean energy workforce representative of state demographics to ensure that wealth building from clean energy jobs occur in the most impacted communities, and ensuring that decision making around clean energy includes and is influenced by these communities. Other solutions also exist, as my fellow presenters have mentioned and will show here. Thank you for your time today, Madam Chair and Committee Representatives. I will pass along to you to send it back to my fellow colleague presenter.
Thank you, Ms. Baines, for your testimony. Next, we'll have Mari Ojeda, also with Fresh Energy. Please state your name for the record and first with your testimony. There are musical chairs too.
Oh boy, it's been a while. There we go. Hello again, everyone. My name is Mari Ojeda,
Senior Policy Associate on the Energy Access and Equity team at Fresh Energy. And today I'll be discussing the intersection of energy and housing affordability and how addressing these issues can reduce costs for households, particularly the ones that are most under-resourced. And I'll be using the term under-resourced kind of interchangeably for low-income, marginalized folks. So if you hear that term, that's what I'm referring to. So this map is highlighting energy burden in Minnesota. Energy burden is the household income that's spent on energy. This is a city view. And then this is showing 60% or less of area median income, so what we're defining as under-resourced households on this map here, and they are experiencing energy burden four times higher than the state average of 2%. So they're experiencing energy burden at 8%. And then some folks in greater Minnesota, some households are also experiencing energy burden that's above 30%. So the darker the color, the higher the energy burden here. And then this is just a county view for comparing the next map here, which is also a county view of housing cost burden. And so the darker the color, the higher the housing cost burden. Housing cost burden is the percent of one's household income that is spent on housing. To be the definition of being cost burden is paying 30% or more of your income on your home, whether that's rent or your mortgage. And then being severely cost burden is paying 50% or more of your income on your home. And then more than 25% of Minnesota households are paying more than that they can afford in their housing. And this map in particular is highlighting renters in particular. And then here are some issues that are contributing to energy unaffordability. As Ms. Schuler mentioned, extreme weather events where heat waves are happening earlier and longer.
Some other things that are contributing to these extreme events is history of redlining, heat island effect, as Ms. Baines mentioned, and then also just not many places having adequate air conditioning. So there's a growing need to address adequate cooling, efficient cooling in the summertime. And then another contributing factor is just rising costs, rising housing costs in particular, plus insufficient housing stock, especially affordable units, affordable housing stock. Rents are quickly rising. There are disparities across race who owns their homes. There's disparities across homeowners versus renters. So really thinking about the various factors that contribute to rising housing costs and insufficient housing stock. And then just the intersection of rising energy costs and rising housing costs is meaning that more Minnesotans are paying much more of their income trying to just simply maintain a comfortable, safe, and healthy home. So just really focusing in a little bit more on energy burden in particular and so, the overall concept of energy efficiency helping to reduce housing and energy costs. Energy efficiency is a solution to driving down the cost of housing and energy. It is also improving it also improves the comfort, health, safety, and indoor air quality of the home in particular. And then as we really think about who's accessing energy and energy efficiency programs and improvements, it's really important to consider the specific living situations. Renters, those living in multifamily housing, and under-resourced customers, such as those with lower incomes, are often harder to reach through traditional generic energy efficiency programming because of their own unique challenges and barriers. Renters in particular have additional barriers such as the split incentive problem, so that idea of the property owner versus kind of the renter who's investing in the energy efficiency improvements and who's benefiting from those energy and cost savings. And then it gets a little bit more complicated when you have a property manager involved. It contributes to the communication barrier there. So just really being mindful about the particular needs of renters. And then multifamily housing has its own inherently more complex issues, such as what do you do with the shared spaces, such as laundry rooms, hallways. It's inherently a bigger building. There are separate units that you have to focus in on for energy efficiency upgrades. So it just overall means costlier upgrades. And then other key issues are to better identify and understand the gaps and where to target funding through better data. Achieving deeper energy and cost savings as opposed to some of the traditional energy efficiency measures. So for instance, the low-hanging fruit such as replacing lighting, how do we really think holistically at the building level and look ambitiously on the benefits of deeper energy investments? And then also thinking about moderate income folks, so folks that actually are not low income as our programs are defined and make slightly above the income threshold to not be able to qualify for low income energy efficiency programs. So how can we really think about those folks and better serve them as we think about energy efficiency and reducing their energy burden? And then some solutions that Fresh Energy is supportive of as we think about reducing housing cost burdens and energy cost burdens expanding and deepening energy efficiency in general. So we do a lot of work at the State Energy Office through their weatherization assistance program and through pre-weatherization advocacy. So the weatherization assistance program provides home repairs and upgrades to under-resourced households to make their homes safer and more efficient. And then just a special note that the state does have an opportunity to fund weatherization above and beyond what the federal program currently does to make sure that more Minnesotans have healthier, safer homes that help them save money on their bills. And pre-weatherization addresses health, safety, structural issues that are not directly tied to energy-saving measures but are necessary before doing the weatherization measures. So, for example, roof repairs, asbestos, lead, and mold abatement are examples of pre-weatherization. And then utility energy efficiency programs, I just put on this slide here as another pathway of investing in energy efficiency and reducing folks' energy burdens. And then really thinking about what is truly affordable and efficient housing, we need to increase investment in affordable housing and efficient housing, And it's really important to create and improve upon our programs in order to reach people who most need them. So renters, multifamily and affordable housing residents, among which under-resourced Minnesotans and Minnesotans of color are overrepresented. So by focusing on these communities who need the most support, the programs end up helping everyone. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you to both Ms. Baines and Ojeda for your presentations. And I think we've got time for a couple of questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, you know, you appreciate your presentation and time you took to put together. You talked a lot about just housing access and ability to find affordable housing. Did your group study at all the effects of, like, rent controls? I've heard I think it was St. Paul put rent controls, so they kind of capped the amount of rent that people would pay. Any idea what that's done as far as availability or new projects going in into the city, whether more or less, or projects are getting canceled, or kind of what, you know, as far as how is that helping people?
Excuse me, Chair Acom, thank you, Representative, for the question. We haven't, our organization has not studied the effects of rent control. We'd be happy to provide resources for studying those effects. We haven't really discussed that as part of this presentation. We just kind of did an overarching, like, high-level presentation of the issues to present today, but we'd totally be happy to provide more details.
Next up, we have Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment to thank you for this presentation, and I really appreciated that you highlighted that transportation was, you know, the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, and I appreciated your, you know, 3 points at the end on page 4 in terms of, you know, what we can do to address this. And so just a quick question on electrification. Do you have some ideas, again, as we move towards the transition to an electrification is one of many. I appreciated active transportation, you know, better public transit. But as we move towards electrification, do you have some thoughts about how to make that transition more equitable?
Thank you, Representative and Madam Chair. So yes, there's a lot of solutions we tend to think about when it comes to supporting clean energy transition, which includes supporting electrification at the kind of homeowner residence level. So the exciting thing is that federal funding has been made available to support both electric vehicle purchase for both used and new vehicles, as well as a lot of home energy electrification rebates around appliances or electrifying your stovetop and things like that. So Fresh Energy is really encouraging action at the state legislature to make sure there is matching or complementary funding to take the most advantage of that federal funding coming in. And then we'll be working with state agencies to make sure that programs are set up to do these sufficient community outreach and education so that homeowners and residents know that these opportunities exist and that they can partake in it. So that's another really keystone of our advocacy as well. Thank you for the question.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair.
And we've got 3 questions and 3 minutes. So we're going to ask members to be quick if they can. Representative Igo, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll try to wrap this up because I had a kind of a two-part question, so I'll try to wrap it into one here. So in the cover of your presentation, it's understanding climate and environmental disparities in Minnesota. But per some of the other kind of, I guess, presentations we've had in this committee, we can't look at climate and environmental disparities as just a Minnesota issue. It's a global issue, right? You can just... Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if it's a global issue, my concern when we talk about these kind of things, if we're going to talk about increasing electrification and clean energy workforce, we're going to increase the demand for the materials needed to do so. And I know to some of the members on the other side of this committee, I sound like a broken record when I talk about it, but it's the truth. Because if we institute policies like that in this committee and we pass it through the Senate and the governor signs it, we just increase the demand, we push the problem somewhere else. And I'm really getting tired of hearing these presentations. Just think we can push it to the corners of the world where it doesn't matter, because it does matter, members of this committee. So my question to both you as the presenters here, is your group thinking about these things when you talk about policy like this? Are you concerned about the children in Africa? Are you concerned about the families in China? Are you concerned about the emissions that it takes to get those resources to us so they can be used to create this future that you have in your presentation? Thank you.
Response, Ms. Baines.
Thank you, Representative and Madam Chair. So yes, we do think about those issues, and Fresh Energy, while we don't have stance on specific projects at this time, generally support strong labor and environmental standards for our clean energy supply chain and sourcing, as well as just generally what you were asking about. We, you know, do believe that we can make a sustainable local source for clean energy transition, again, with those strong environmental and labor safeguards. It will be a challenge. It will be complicated, but that is not something we think that Minnesotans or the U.S. should shy away from, even though it is, it does present an immense, complex challenge. Thank you.
Representative Garofalo, very quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're confusing cost and price here. So when it comes to electrification, particularly of home heating, it's much more expensive than traditional sources. So I guess my original question, I guess two questions. The first question is, does higher energy prices, does that result in reduced pollution?
Yes, thank you, Representative and Madam Chair. So sorry, let me just, does higher energy prices result in reduced pollution?
Yeah, there's a, Madam Chair, members, there's a theory from someone on the progressive left that by having higher prices, this forces more conservation and people are more responsible in their energy consumption.
Representative Garofalo, we, just so you know, the next presentation is on affordability, energy affordability, but go ahead, Ms. Baines, please.
So is this one. So is affordability.
Yes. Thank you, Representative and Madam Chair. So I think I am familiar with some of those arguments. Here at Fresh Energy, we really believe in supporting an energy transition away from fossil gas and fossil fuels that supports affordability over sort of the method you're describing. So we would support rebates and financial support to make that switch to electrification. We also recognize that home electrification isn't suitable right now for all types of homes, and you know, there is more of a near-term opportunity for folks that are using heating from things like propane or older electric resistance that tends to be much more costly than other home heating services. So we recognize that there is that nuance and there will be a transition of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to home electrification towards all homes being electrified in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your presentations. Last, we do have another presentation from Annie Levinson-Fox, Executive Director for the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota. Welcome to committee. Please enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, committee members. My name is Annie Levinson-Falk. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Minnesota, or CUB. Citizens Utility Board is a nonprofit advocate for Minnesota utility consumers. We're office here in St. Paul, but work statewide. Work directly with people who maybe call us because they're facing a shutoff or have another energy-related question, and we try to help those folks. And we advocate in the consumer interest here at the legislature and at the PUC. And I am going to talk about cost and affordability primarily, and try to take try to not repeat too much of what has already been said here today. So before talking about how affordable is energy in Minnesota, I wanted to take a step back and just try to think about how do we actually define what affordability is. I think the most frequently cited statistic I usually see is rates, specifically electricity rates, and how does Minnesota's electricity rate compare to other places, other parts of the country? So what you see here is Minnesota's average retail electricity rate for all types of customers compared with the U.S. over the past about 10 years. And as you can see, our rate per kilowatt hour of electricity has been increasing relative to the U.S. average. We used to be below average, and now we're pretty much the same as the U.S. average on a per kilowatt hour of electricity. But customers don't pay rates. We, you know, when we get home, you pay your bill. So I think as far as the household impact of the cost of energy, it's usually more useful to look at bills. Rates are certainly an important piece of the information, but it's important also to look at the total bill that a customer is paying. And when you look at the average monthly electricity bill for a residential customer, it's been below average, below the U.S. average in Minnesota, and it continues to be below average. That's held fairly constant as a compared to the U.S. average. Energy burden is a more nuanced, I'd say, measure of affordability, as the previous presenter touched on. This map shows a map of of energy burden measured as the percent of household income that households are dedicating towards home energy, electric, natural gas, heating. It could be propane, fuel oil, wood, whatever it is that you heat your home with. Typically, an energy burden of around 5 or 6% is what's often considered affordable. I don't think there's any magic, you know, number there. But higher energy burdens correlate particularly with rural areas, lower income households, which is probably not a surprise, and communities of color. Particularly, I think you can almost see here where the tribal lands are in Minnesota. Tribal nation lands tend to see very high energy costs. And other parts of rural parts of the state do as well. It's interesting to zoom in on the cities, and you can see in more detail what it looks like in different neighborhoods in the urban areas as well. As far as how actual households are doing, though, we do have really good data from Minnesota's regulated utilities that shows, are people actually able to afford their electric and their natural gas bills, and how has that been changing over time? So all of the regulated utilities in Minnesota report data on customer arrearages every month, and we keep a pretty close eye on that. What this graph shows is the trend in the number of households that are behind on their bills and what that's looked like since 2019. I think when you're looking at this data, it's important to look back prior to COVID because a lot of funky stuff happened over the last few years. So I like to look back and say, how are we at this point in the year? Because there's also seasonal trends compared to where we were pre-COVID. And so the yellow line on here, let's see if I have a pointer. The yellow line is 2022. This is showing up through October of 2022. You can see the blue line is 2019. There's slightly more households that are behind on their bills than 2019, but really where you're seeing the bigger impact is those households that are behind, how much do they owe? Here you can see the average household that is past due on their electric and natural gas bills owes like twice as much as they did in 2019. It's really stark. So, and this is also after a lot of additional energy assistance came down during COVID. So any household that received assistance from the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, LIHEAP, anyone who received LIHEAP last year had their past due balance paid off. So even after that, we're seeing, you know, pretty high numbers of households that are in arrears, and those that are behind really owe quite a bit. I think it's kind of that tale of two economies that you've seen over the last few years, where folks that are doing okay are still doing pretty well, even with the current economic situations, and those that are struggling are having more trouble. We see the same thing in energy. So quickly, and I know it's getting close to time, so I won't spend too much time, but I want to talk a little bit about what is driving some of those costs. I'm sure you all have been hearing, like, we have a lot of concern about increasing energy costs in the past year, especially since winter of last year. And most of those increases, the top driver has been fuel prices. Obviously, we're in a global market for fuels, including natural gas. The fuel prices have been quite high lately. This chart is kind of distorted because of this enormous spike. Right here is the winter storm of February 2020, Winter Storm Uri, where gas prices like really shot up astronomically for a very brief period. So it's a little bit hard to see, but the scale of this, these kind of the tails were, I don't know, hopefully coming towards the end. I don't have a crystal ball on natural gas prices, but of a period of really elevated natural gas prices, and those are passed directly to customers. So we saw it wasn't uncommon last winter to see gas prices that were double what they were for, you know, January of 2022 versus 2021. And that's because of fuel prices largely, but you also do see it in your electric bill as well. Electricity generation sources obviously is a big component of what comes into your electric rate. And what this chart shows, this is just one important piece of information, so I don't want to suggest this is the full picture, but this chart shows a comparison of different, the cost to generate electricity using different technologies. This is actual national data compiled every year by Lazard, which is an investment banking firm. And this shows unsubsidized, so this takes out the effects of federal subsidies for wind or solar or anything else. So the unsubsidized cost of wind, for example, it shows here the low end $26 per megawatt hour and the high end $50. In the Midwest, we're commonly more towards the lower end. When you compare that wind, solar, with the fossil resources, gas, coal, you're seeing that they have come down to where they are competitive and often, but not always, beating fossil fuels just on price on a per unit of energy measure. These little diamonds show the operating cost of the more traditional resources. So if you had a coal plant that's already built, you don't need to buy a new one, you just want to run it and maintain it. You're still often, those are getting beat out by building new renewable generation. And so that's pushing a lot of change and some difficulty in the industry. I think a lot of that is coming from economics alone. Obviously, a lot of other factors impact cost. I think I had about 7 minutes today, so I can't really get into everything, but I just wanted to mention a number of other factors. Weather, how cold it is a big determinant of how much you pay and how hot it is in the summer. How efficient your home is, as previous testifiers have talked about. Company profits, I think, you know, it's always something that is litigated. Every time a utility comes in for a rate case, the utilities ask for higher return on their investment, and advocates like us push for a lower one. I think an Xcel is currently before the Public Utilities Commission to increase electric rates, and about 15% of the increase that they've asked for from residential customers would go just to increase their return on equity, just to give you an idea of the scale of that. But there's a lot of else. I apologize for rushing, but I'd be happy to take questions if we have time. Thank you.
Representative Soup, we've got just 2 minutes for Senator
Susan. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, kind of just, you spoke a lot about kind of renewables and their affordability. Does it make sense for Minnesota to have policy that allows more expensive solar to crowd out industrial solar on an industrial scale? Is that what's best for ratepayers?
Thank you, Chair Akam and Representative Swedzinski. I think that's probably a complicated question. I mean, I think if the only factor you're looking at is cost, obviously lower cost is better. But there is a lot more, I think, to the energy questions. That there's employment, there's local benefits, there's the cost of transmission and distribution. And there's a lot else in those solar policies that sometimes the advocates are pushing. I mean, I think we certainly are concerned about cost and sometimes are concerned about the cost of certain solar as well. So I'd be happy to talk to you more about that. I don't know if there's like a black and white answer to that question.
Thank you. If CUB was to choose 100 megawatts of industrial solar, or let's say I'll just pick a program of community solar out of the blue, what do you think would be most beneficial at the bottom line to low income individuals?
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, we actually did a very detailed energy system modeling in Xcel, its integrated resource plan, a few years back, and the answer was both. It didn't model the community solar program that we have in Minnesota. I think there's probably ways, I know that there's ways that program can be improved. But as far as what is the lowest cost option for ratepayers, it was a mix of utility scale solar and solar that was tied into the distribution system.
Thank you, Ms. Levinson-Falk, and to all the presenters today on the equitable energy transition. With that, I will say we are adjourned.